Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. This evening's event is presented by Inforum. It's a division of the club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with the mission of inspiring debate in civic issues. They've just launched their newest In the Know campaign. Essentially, blind faith is now truly blind, and now it's time to start participating. If you keep repeating all the arguments of the past, you're just going to be stuck there. So it's got to change now. Today, you need to be in the know. If you want to get any more information online, they're at commonwealthclub.com/inforum. As Caroline said, I'm Cassandra Phillips. I'm the creator and producer of FailCon, a conference on business failures that we just had in October. I'm also the founder of Web Wallflower Events. I'll be moderating the discussion here with Barry Maltz on failing up in business. Barry Maltz, you're an entrepreneurship expert, I am told. You founded a number, You founded and started a number of businesses and run a number of them with quite a fair share of failures and successes. You recently wrote the book Bounce, which I happily got a copy of, as well as You Need to Be a Little Crazy, and your newest book is BAM. Barry Maltz is here to share with us some of his stories of failure. You have a slightly unorthodox approach to what failure and what success are, so I'm looking forward to kind of hearing a little bit about that. Jumping right into that, you do have a really unique approach to failure. What are some of your thoughts on it? Do you think it's a good thing, a bad thing?
Well, I think, Cassie, you know, the conventional wisdom in this world is that failure is a good thing. That failure is a good thing because we always can learn something from failure, so isn't that great? And for me, I think that mostly failure just stinks. Many times there's really isn't nothing to learn, right? I mean, in my last company, when my largest customer was indicted by the government, what was I supposed to learn? Not do business with criminals? Or when my best employee left because her husband got a job in another state, when I'm supposed to learn not to hire married people. I think that what we have to, the way we have to treat failure is that it's just part of the business cycle, even when there isn't something to learn. Failure is just like success. There are failures and there are successes, and we need to accept both of them.
Sure. So a lot of, I think some of our acceptance of failure comes from how we teach our children of, you got to stay hopeful. You have to stay, those failures are great. Good job on that mistake. How do you think we should start approaching failure just from the very young age, just at a social level?
Well, I think that, you know, failure obviously has a very difficult connotation. Any of you who have read this month's issue of Wired Magazine, I mean, what's on the cover of Wired Magazine this month? Well, besides a picture of, I believe that's Alec Baldwin, right? Yeah. Of Alec Baldwin there, it just says fail. And this really typifies what the world and how we typically treat failure as Americans. The first one is fail. Screw-ups, disasters, misfires, and flops. I have to tell you, we love to read about other people's failures, don't we? We love Schadenfreude. That is really where reality TV shows come from. Because when we see those shows, Cassie, what are we all thinking? We're thinking, thank God, it's not me, right? That's really what we like. Sure. So that's the first thing we like to read about. The second thing is most people say there's always something good to come from failure. We always can learn something. And I think that's just a bunch of crap because I believe that's the story that we tell ourselves when we're failing, that there's got to be something to learn, that I can't leave this place of failure until I figure out why did it happen to me and what there is to learn. And then finally, as in Wired Magazine has, we always like to read famous people, successful people that have failed and come back. And typically, successful people, they only talk about their failures once they're really successful. And then, of course, their failures are like worse than they ever really
right,
were.
Of course. So then how should I handle failure as not Alec Baldwin and not Mark Zuckerberg?
I think the way that we should handle failure is when we do fail, I think that we should have a pity party for ourselves. I think that we should cheer the darkness. I think that we should feel real good and sorry for ourselves for about 24 hours. Then what you need to do is you need to learn whatever you can, because I'm not saying there isn't something to learn. Sometimes there is. Learn what you can, but then you have to let go and move on. The most difficult part of the whole failure-success cycle is really letting go of that failure, by letting go, you give yourself another chance at success.
Right. Now, how would you let go? I mean, we find in social media and in Wired that everyone keeps talking about your failures. They keep wanting to let you know about them. Your family brings it up. How would you suggest that I start letting it go?
Well, after you have your pity party, right?
Okay.
Right? Because you got to have that
champagne.
Pity party for 24 hours. Because I think it's important to mourn it. I think you have to really face the fear of failure. In our society, there's a lot of things that say no fear, that we should not be afraid of failing. And I think that's just stupid because we should be afraid. Fear is part of what's really out there for us. I believe you should be afraid, but go ahead and do it anyways if you can handle the consequences. I do about 100,000 miles a year flying, and I hate to fly. And so how do I do it? Well, I have a special playlist on my iPhone called Turbulence Tunes. So whenever the turbulence gets bad, I play that, and it kind of gets me through it. So first thing you have to do is face the fear. The second thing that's important, as you were hitting on, was you have to give up the shame. There's a lot of shame that happens when we do fail. We feel bad. We think it's our fault. I believe you just say, well, I did the best I could, and failure happened to me. Sometimes it's my fault. Sometimes it's not. That would really be the second step. Finally, once you get through this, you should realize that failure actually gives you choices. Many people are very unhappy in their current job they're having that they have, and they just keep complaining about it, right?
Sure.
Actually, when you get fired from that job, you have no choice but to go look for another job. So it actually gives you a choice. Once you're out there on the street, I think the most important thing is to set some kind of patient interim goal. Try to set yourself up for some type of very small success so you can start to get your confidence back. Those are the steps I think that we need to go through.
Mm-hmm. You've talked a little bit with me about how having an outside person to kind of help you out or outside objects or things like that. Could you go on a little bit about that? Who do you try and find in your life to help you pull yourself out of these little shame pity parties?
Well, let's talk about the objects first. I mean, when we were very young, we always got ribbons, right? We always got trophies. And there's very few opportunities now, really, to get ribbons and trophies.
I want to get trophies in my job, Mom.
I want to get trophies. I want to get ribbons. You want those kinds of things. Some people keep a success journal. When things are going poorly for me, what I do is I try to go back and look at those trophies, look at the times that I was successful. You know, Cassie, there's a phrase that says, good times don't last forever. But there's a corollary that says bad times don't last forever either. These times will change too. And I think in order to pull upon your resiliency when you do fail, it's good to remember the times where you were successful. If you have trophies, if you have ribbons, you have a success journal, maybe you have a folder in Microsoft Outlook. I have a folder called Kudos, people what time they've congratulated me. That really helps. It also is good to keep other people around you that can help. I think everyone having a mentor is very important. The key is to have a mentor who's going to tell you the truth, when you need to wallow, but at the same time, when to really move on.
Sure. So now you've done some advising for companies,
right.
And you talk a little bit about sometimes a company just needs to make its own choices. In the end, you have to make a choice. And you and I talked a little bit about the role of the advisor in the company. So when should I be listening to my advisor? When I think he's wrong or she's wrong, should I be taking that into consideration? How do I negotiate that with my own kind of feelings of what's going to end up being right and successful?
I think it's a really good question because I think basically we are a very lazy society. We always want those 7 steps to success, right? We all read books that tell us 10 ways to do this, 5 ways to this, because we think that if we follow the exact steps that Donald Trump followed, if we follow the exact steps that Barack Obama followed, we'll be able to be successful just like them. And guess what? You just can't. What I think we need to do is we need to listen and take advice from all the people around us, our mentors, anybody we listen to, and then integrate into something that works for us. If you find a group of mentors that works for you and all of a sudden you think their advice is crazy, maybe it's you that have gone crazy and not them, so you probably should look to them. The key is to find a group of people that you can trust over a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier the importance of having small goals, of having just little landmarks along the way. How do you suggest kind of starting those? When I'm first starting, I don't really know even how to set my own goals. Do you have any tips on like how to set your first goals, your first milestones?
It's interesting because years ago I got into Zen meditation and I went to my Zen master and I said, well, I want to meditate at home. How do I start? And he said, well, I think you go home. Why don't you try to meditate for 1 minute a day? And I said, okay. He goes, and if that works out well after 3 months, try 90 seconds.
What's funny is that is exactly what one of my meditation professors said as well.
So they all went to the same school.
They did, I swear.
But we don't do that in America. What we really try to do is we join the health club on January 1st. And what do? We go to the health club every single day for the first 7 days we belong. And then the second week, you know how long how many days we go? We go 6 days, then 5 days, and three. And by February 1st, we're no longer going to the health club. Yep. We try to bite off too much. And I believe if we set small interim goals, we'll get to where we want to go. If you've ever been a sailor where you have to go across a very windy lake, many times you can't go directly at your target. You have to tack. You have to go in one direction, then next direction, next direction. And these small iterative steps, although they're not the most direct, will get you where you want to go.
Sure. Now, in a presentation of yours that I saw, I actually was really intrigued that you seem to not like business plans.
Right.
And so with this way of setting all these little minuscule goals, if I'm a new startup, which I am, how do I get an investor? How do I make a business plan? I feel like you still need a big goal, a dream to be kind of aspiring to.
Well, I always say that business plans are really meaningless, right? They always say exactly the same thing, right? In year five, we all get rich.
Right.
That's what every single business plan really says, and they all have the same graph that goes to the right. When I say business plans are meaningless, in fact, I wrote the preface to a book called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Business Plans. When I say that they're meaningless, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't write them. The process of actually writing a business plan, setting your goals, figuring out what does it cost to acquire a customer, what does it cost to produce your product or service, these things are important. But you have to realize that it's going to change, that it's going to happen over a long period of time, and you have to be flexible. Mm-hmm. I think it's great to set those goals that are out there and say, what do you want to be when you grow up? What's your grand vision? But at the same time, in order to get there, you can't just jump to that grand vision. You got to do step one, step two, step three. Many of us are really great, Cassie, at setting grand visions, but a lot of us aren't really going on saying, okay, let's go out and let's get that first paying customer that's going to buy our product that's not a relative of ours.
Mm-hmm. On that note, for me, I struggle with the issue of I define success as when I've hit that grand mm-hmm. goal. It's like, okay, when my company is making millions, right. I'm successful. How would you define success? How should I approach success? Which is actually a question that I've never been able to define success for myself.
I think everyone's going to come up with their own definition of success. For me, success is being able to support my family. It's something I enjoy doing. And when I speak, I poll people all the time and saying, well, is success about money? And a lot of people say success isn't about money. And I think that's just a bunch of crap. Success definitely is about money. I mean, you have to pay your bills with money. However, if success is only about money, then I think you're also missing something. Maybe there isn't a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for all of us. I think we have to figure out what are our money plus goals. Cassie, you have to think about what is going to make you what I call happily successful. How do you balance money and fun? That's really what your definition of success, and each of us has to ask our own. But success has to include money, because guess what? At least in this country, that's the way we keep score.
Sure. And that's what we talked a little bit backstage about, other ways of keeping score now with the social media and the Twitter followers and your Facebook friends, and insane. But going back to the goals, I missed one of my things. I've been told that a number of people in the audience are starting their own businesses or working in business. What are some of the goals that you think a business should have set at the early stages? What should be some things that I have on my little checklist, to-do list, just in specifics?
Well, I think it all depends on what your goal is in going to a business. Do you just want it to be a lifestyle business, or somewhere along the line, do you want to get investors? Do you want to get venture capital money? The most important success goal you can have is actually very, very simple. It's to get paying customers, right? It's not creating a product. It's not creating a distribution channel. It's getting someone to say to you, guess what? You solved the pain that I have so much that I'm going to pay you to solve it. If you have paying customers in this world, when you have a business, everything else will come pretty easily.
It's very true. I need to get a couple more of those. So going back to the failure, which is, you know, failing up is our topic. Are there any good tips on how to avoid failures, steps I should take?
Let's go back to what, I don't think failure is a good thing or a bad thing. Most of the popular media say that failure is a good thing and most of us think in our souls that failure is a bad thing. We just have to really look at it as part of the business cycle. There are failures, successes, successes, failures. Now, are there things that we can do? Well, of course, I think that if we work really hard, I think that if we refine the processes and don't focus on the outcome, but focus the process to get there, mm-hmm. and if we have timing and luck on our side, then we could be successful more times than failures. And that's really what you want to do. You want to try to be successful more than you are a failure. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of studying on one-hit wonders, which I've always been fascinated about. People in the music business, they only had one hit. And I interviewed a lot of these people, and I said, well, are you disappointed that you only had one hit one time? And they said, no, I was just glad I had that one hit one time because it really gets me through some of the difficult times.
Sure. Sure. That reminds me of your lottery story of
right.
people who win the lottery and people who get in car accidents.
Right. You want to tell the story?
No, you should tell the story. It's your story.
It's not my story. It's very interesting. I've always been fascinated by this link between money and happiness because, of course, when I was growing up, my mother told me that money would mean success, would mean happiness. She told me, since I came from a Jewish family, she told me if I had money in my pocket, people would think I was handsome, wise, and even be able to sing. And that's kind of how we look at people that have a lot of money in our society. So there was a study that was done years ago that looked at people that had been in a car accident and people that had won the lottery. And they looked at these people's level of happiness before their incident and after their incident. And it's interesting because who do you think was happier right after their incident? The people that had just been in a car accident or the people that had won the lottery? I'm glad you say that because a lot of times people go, oh, the people that were in the car accident. And I'm like, huh? I said, next time you win the lottery, I'll bring you to a car accident. You give me the money. The people, obviously, who won the lottery, they were a lot happier. What's very interesting about it, however, is that just 8 weeks after their particular incident, the people returned to their original levels of happiness. So having the money was really only a temporary boost, or getting in a car accident was really only a temporary down. So I've always found that very, very interesting. I think there's an intrinsic level of happiness, intrinsic level of success that we feel.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is changing the topic slightly. At FailCon, which I recently hosted, I got a question frequently that I didn't really have a good answer to, which is a lot of times we get stuck in our work and we see our project and we're like, all right, it's not going well, but I'm going to keep working at it. I'm going to be tenacious. I'm going to get there. Do you have any advice on, especially in business or in our lives, that we should just say, okay, it's done. Yeah. I failed. I need to move on. And when I should keep being tenacious because I might get that success.
You know, it's a difficult one, Cassie, because in our society there's a phrase that says, winners never quit and quitters never win, right? We've heard that? Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Winners in this world, they actually know when to quit.
Right.
There's another great phrase that says, if I find myself in a hole, the first thing I'm going to do is stop digging. Right?
Yes.
The test that I think most people should put themselves against, whether they should quit or not, you have to look at two things. One is, do you still have the passion to keep doing what you're doing? If you don't have the passion for your business, your profession, there's a good cue you should quit. The second thing really is cash flow. What direction is cash flow going in? If it keeps going down and you don't see a way to bail yourself out, and most people cannot bail themselves out through sales, then it may be called time to quit. The wise people really know when to quit. If you look at any successful business person in this world, they know when to quit. There's a there's a national restaurateur, his name is Rich Melman, and he has dozens and dozens of restaurants all over the country. He knows when to open them and he knows when to close them. If you know when to close them, you can really be successful because you don't dwell on your failures. At the same time, you shouldn't give up too soon. Right. And that's really what the balance really is.
Right.
Many times, however, I think there's a third alternative. And the third alternative is actually to morph it into something else. Mm. Venture capitalists report that 80% of the businesses they invest in, 5 years later, that business is doing something different. Most businesses start over here and end up doing something different. So, for example, the company Nokia, some of you may have Nokia phones. That company is 130 years old, right? I mean, they used to do rubber tires and rubber boots. Now
really?
They do cell phones. eBay, what was their original business idea? It was to sell auction software, not to do the auction. Cabbage Patch Dolls. Anybody have a Cabbage Patch Doll when they were? Guys, it's okay. You can raise your hands. Cabbage Patch Dolls were created by a company called Coleco. and that stood for the Connecticut Leather Company. They didn't start out in toys. So usually the third alternative is people usually take, if they're failing at something, if they're good and they think through it, they actually morph to something else, then actually be reborn.
Sure. That's what actually my next fail chat's going to be on, is what people are calling now the pivot,
right?
Which is having a company being able to shut its doors and confidently, you know, close down temporarily and reopen with a new business plan. Or YouTube also had a similar story where a guy started as a dating site and moved on to videos. So
that worked out pretty well, right?
That did work out really well. they're doing pretty well for themselves, from what I've heard. So going on, and you had talked about, you know, goals and you just need to take action. That's a big thing of yours. How when I have one of these, a question I had earlier, I'm jumping to a different question that I had. I had a company that we ended up shutting down, and I never considered it a failure. And you talk about these guys know how to quit. That's going somewhat back to the definition of failure, of when should you consider something a failure versus just moving on or closing your doors and reopening? Is that a failure?
Well, I prefer not to label things, right?
Right.
I mean, my son, for a long time, he kept on, you know, doing this, he kept on putting an L over his head, which is like loser, right?
Yep.
I mean, I don't think
From
we should
80s.
Try to label things. I don't think that it's a failure really until you're dead. I think you got to just kind of keep morphing mm-hmm. into whatever the next iteration really
is.
Which
I feel like would really help me recover. I know one of my business partners considered it a failure, and it hurt him really badly, where I considered it, well, that was a fun project, we closed it down, and I'm now doing something else.
Well, I think one of the ways you can look at it is we found out what didn't work.
Right.
Now let's find out if there's something else that does work or something else that doesn't work. I mean, as long as you can still get another chance, then why is it really a failure?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the good things about America, which is very different than the rest of the world. You actually get additional chances in America. In Asian cultures, they are so adverse to failure that many times if you fail, you actually have to move out of the country. America has always been founded that. I wouldn't say that failure is okay, because I believe we pay a lot of lip service for failure being okay. However, you do get to come back. Our bankruptcy laws, are even the recent changes, are a lot more lenient than anything else that's
mm-hmm.
out there, Cassie.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked about recently the desire to see failure conferences out in Europe now, in South America, with that the nation or the international community recognizing that failure is, as you say, just part of the business cycle.
Right. I think the most important thing about failure is if we could just forgive ourselves, if we could give up the shame, it will really allow us to let go and to really move on. When you let go, you give yourself another chance. Remember, success is always about having multiple chances to succeed, because eventually you will succeed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk a lot about it. This is going back to the question I was asking about taking action, and that being the best way to get out of a hole is to stop digging and make a decision. Frequently, I found that in startups, people will make those decisions almost ignorantly, that they're launching so quickly, they're not taking into consideration some of the facts that in another week of research they could have had. When do I continue working on a new project on before I launch it, and when do I just say, I got to do it. I got to launch it right now. Any advice on that?
I think it's a balance, right? I mean, it's somewhere along the line, you have to stop typing and start prototyping, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to back away from the computer. It's very easy to write a business plan. Somewhere along the line, you have to go and ask a customer, will they buy your product? And so I always think that we should take action, but the kind of action that I want to take are very, very small iterative steps. I don't want to say, all right, let's go out now, let's launch $1 million marketing campaign. Let's do a Super Bowl commercial. I don't believe in necessarily bold actions like that, especially at the startup phase. I believe that we should take very, very small steps so we can see, does it succeed, does it fail, does it succeed, does it fail? And you constantly evolve and change your strategy as you inch along. I think that will help. So you'll have many, many successes and many, many failures.
Sure, sure. Now, this is going to go on to a little bit of with your book, BAM. I could definitely see social media helping with that, on being able to kind of reach out to your customers and your potential clients at a much more bootstrapped level. I don't know if you had any comments on that with the new book, BAM, coming out.
Well, I think that one of the good things about social media, it gives you an opportunity to get immediate feedback. But now remember, many of us are afraid to get feedback, Cassie. We don't want to necessarily hear what the customers really have to say. Sometimes we do surveys, but we don't really want to hear what mm-hmm. people really think. Be careful the questions you ask, because sometimes people will tell you what they really think.
Right.
But social media, you'll be able to get some immediate reaction, which I think is a really good thing, so you'll be able to change and evolve rather than getting set in one way.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of startups have talked to me about how Their customers never actually know what they want. They like to complain. Customers love to complain. But it's very hard for them to say exactly what they would like to see. As a business owner, what should I be listening to? Is there a sign of a good customer, a sign of a customer that I should take on as a pseudo-advisor?
I think you have to look at where people have pain and where people have money to solve the pain. People only buy when they're in pain, especially in a difficult economy about this. People don't buy vitamins, right? They buy painkillers. Look at where your customers are spending money to solve their pain. So, for example, when I go to the movie theater, why do I buy a bottle of water for $4? Because I'm thirsty, right? When I go to the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, why do I spend $6 on a plain bagel? Well, because I'm hungry. So people buy when they're in pain. We have to look to see what their behavior is like and really follow the money.
Sure, sure. So totally just lost my train of thought. So looking at kind of the structure of when I'm setting out both my life paralleling my business,
right,
and saying, okay, so I can look at business failure. I have advisors. I have a business plan. I have my set goals. What can I take into my life for my own personal mistakes that I might make? Are there any things that I could look at from my business and apply? Any mentors that I could use in my own life? People I should look to? Resources I could kind of rely on?
I would really look at the question, Cassie, a little bit differently, because I think one of the difficulties that we really have is we have a tendency, whatever we do professionally, to reflect who we are.
Right.
And when we fail in our business, when we get fired, and I've been fired many times, we think that it's a personal failing of our own, and we take it personally. And I think you have to realize that no matter how much work or effort you put into your career or your business, you are not your business. And actually, studies show that it's actually tougher for men than it is really for women to really get over that, because men actually define themselves more by what they do than women do. Because women are really better at having personal relationships. They're able to give birth to a family, things like that. Men put too many eggs in the whole career basket. They define themselves by what they do. So I think if you can find some separation between
those two.
Yeah, some separation that you're just not your business. Mm-hmm. I think that can help. And what you have to really also realize that when you do fail, the people that care about you and the people who love you, they'll probably still care about you and love you. Mm-hmm. And they'll be rooting for you to go back and do it again.
Right. So would you call some of the things going on to kind of the bigger scale, would you call some of the things that are going on right now with the healthcare bill, with the auto industry, failures? And especially in this time of recession, you talk about that's the time that a business should be taking off. How can we kind of learn from those people and then use the recession to our own advantage?
Well, I mean, we're talking, backstage also that this is just another cycle, right? This happens to be a really, really bad cycle. It was funny. My 6-year-old son said to me the other day, he said, "Dad, how bad is this recession on a scale of 1 to 10? I said, "Well, Ethan, it's like a 9 on a scale of 1 to 10. He goes, "That's funny." He goes, "I don't feel a thing." And I'm like, well, I guess I'm doing a pretty
16,
good job with it.
Right.
You're 16. This is just a cycle. It happens to be a very bad and global cycle. But guess what? This will end sometime soon as well. I mean, those of you who go back, you remember the .com. You remember the stuff that happened in the early 90s. You remember, this is for 20s and 30s. You remember during a lot of the Arab-Israeli war with the oil embargo. I mean, these kinds of cycles happen. It's just one of those kinds of things. I think one of the things you can learn during this type of time is, what are the industries that are still left standing? No matter what the cycle is, what do people still buy? And I think that's an important thing that we can learn and try to wrap your business around that.
Sure, sure. So if I'm starting in a recession, which I am, I happened to start this just about 3 months ago, I noticed that right away I have, cheaper resources. Right. I definitely have things like that. Are there some just like clear steps that you'd say, should I actually start in a recession in my business? I've heard one of my advisors said, I should be starting in a recession, wait for the recession to get worse.
I don't think you can time it. I think it's silly to try to time. I started my first business right after I got married. That's a really bad idea. I started my second business right after my first son was born. That's an even worse idea.
Did either of those get anywhere? Right?
No, they both went out of, I went out of business and I was kicked out of, I went out of business in my first business. I was kicked out of business in my second business. My third business I sold. That's why I'm sitting here today with you. But you can't really pick it. We can't wait for that perfect time to bounce. more businesses than not start during a recession. And why is that? Because people are out of work and resources are cheap. That's why so many businesses get started. If you feel it's the right time for you, go for it. But I don't think you really get to choose. If you try to time it, people always say to me, well, Barry, what are the hot startups I should really get involved in now? If I would mention what the hot startups now, it's already too late.
Right. You would have invested in them.
You would have invested
made
them.
Your millions.
They would have done it already. So whatever you feel passionate about, whenever it fits into your life, that's when you should go do it. And remember, when you start, you're also very, very small. It only takes a handful of customers to make you successful. Mm. I don't think the recession really applies to startups or to entrepreneurs because it doesn't take that many people for you to have a really great year. You're not General Motors, for God's sakes.
Right. I mean, that goes back to about a year ago. I had 10 friends out here, and about 8 of my 10 friends were laid off, fired, or left unemployed. 6 of them have now gone on to start their own business and are paying all of their bills, which I thought was a very interesting reflection of just how a recession, your idea of when you're fired, you don't get to think about your choice anymore.
Right.
You're just forced to make a choice. And you and I.
When you find yourself out in the street, that's why I think failure gives you choices. You have no, if you have to support yourself or your family, you have no choice but to find some work. If you can't find a job, you make one. And actually, there's a lot of talk around now how we're each our own personal brand, about personal branding, Cassie.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that's really what the future is. Whether people actually start their own businesses formally in the long run or not, what life and careers will really look like in the future is a series of independent gigs doing loose collaborations with a series of people. Everyone really in the future will be their own business, their own company, whether they like it or not.
So you think a lot of this loyalty that we see with like the 20-year employee, the 25-year employee is going away?
I think it's already gone away. I really do. I mean, I think the watch industry has gone way down. You're not going to have those golden watches. I think that loyalty can exist on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
I think a loyalty can exist between people, between individuals. I think that there's a lot of loyalty. There's a good amount of loyalty online, and I think that's a good thing.
How would you kind of generate that loyalty in your clients and in your customers?
I believe that for your customers, I believe that if you solve their pain at a value, people will stay loyal to you. If you try to fulfill what they need, if you give them more than they asked you for, they'll come back. Remember, the only sustainable competitive advantage really is your customers, right? The loyalty of your customers and perhaps of your employees. That's really it. There's no patent, there's no formula you can make up that really makes a sustainable competitive advantage. So, and I think you have to be really, really open and honest. Well, the good thing about social media now, Cassie, is it's forcing us to be open and honest because there really, quite honestly, is no place to hide any longer.
Right.
Anything you do is public information, pretty much. Everything is recorded. Everything is online. It's there online forever.
Including all of your failures.
Exactly.
How to struggle.
Exactly. That's why the sooner you let them go, the better.
Sure, sure. So I have a friend right now actually dealing with this issue. When you talk about when you're laid off from a business, you're forced to kind of go start your own thing. What happens when you have your idea and you're still at a business? When do you take that plunge and actually leave? Do you wait for the investor money to come? In which case, I would say it's probably not going to come. You're not dedicating your time to getting it. Any suggestions on, you know, someone has an idea and they want to start a company? When do they leave their safe blanket?
If they have a job?
They have a job. When do they leave their job for their totally unpredictable startup that we know nothing about?
It's kind of interesting because I'm not a really big fan of leaving your day job, right? You know, they say don't quit your day job. I think you should keep your day job as long as you can because generating income and getting paid is difficult. Get your idea out there, create a product or service, get people to pay you, and then maybe you can leave your day job. But if you have a job, I would keep it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a lot of bravado in saying, all right, I'm gonna take the plunge. I'm quitting my job. I'm going to start my own company. And I would say, what are you, stupid? Right? Keep your day job as long as you can and do this other thing on the side till you can't balance them any longer. But if you're already out of work, you've got nothing to lose but go and launch it and try to find some customers that will pay you money to solve their pain.
So you're at a point now that you can't balance it any longer. Your new startup isn't making money yet, but it has so much potential. That kind of goes back to the idea of where your advisor comes in?
Well, you can ask your advisors, but no one's going to be able to tell you except you and your family. And I think that y'all should have a contingency plan. I invested, I when I sold my last business, we had borrowed $1.3 million from the bank. And luckily, we paid them back. And that was probably one of the happiest days of my life. And after that, when I sold my business, we immediately put all the money in my wife's name so I could never hurt myself again. And that actually has paid off over the last 10 years. I think you always have to keep something in reserve because you have to leave a little bit of money out there so you can always live another day. Mm-hmm. But somewhere along the line, you will have to jump. And no one can tell you when the right time to jump really is.
Sure.
No matter what you learn, no matter what people are going to tell you, you won't really ever know. But you have to ask yourself, if I don't jump, will I be upset in the future that I never really took the chance? Will my life really be complete? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have my father who's now 75 years old, and he's doing what he really wanted to do his whole life, which is really woodworking and being a craftsman. He should have done it 50 years ago, but he never was able to.
Mm-hmm. So now, do you really think it's crazy to start your own business?
Oh, it's definitely insane, but I think that we should do it anyways.
Okay.
I mean, you have to be crazy to start your own business. It makes no sense. The risk that you take in order to get the financial payoff makes no sense at all. At the same time, it's the best and the worst times of my life. Most people start their own businesses like me because we're entrepreneurholics, right? We have no choice. We really don't. If I could work for somebody else, Cassie, I would.
Yeah, you and I talked about that.
I can't. And so we go out and we just do it. I want to see my ideas succeed or fail. That's the reward for myself. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I am most proud of in my life, as I said before, I'm able to support my family and myself in something I enjoy. What more could you want out of life?
Mm-hmm. And you and I have talked about there's, and this can be just part of the personality that someone would need to develop, is I have a little bit of joy in just being able to take on my own failures and call them mine and properly label them and not have to say, oh, management handled something wrong or the guy down the hall from me handled something wrong.
Well, listen, there's a statistic that says, Cassie, that most people start their businesses because they hate their bosses, right? I mean, when I was at IBM, I started my first business because I hated my boss. He used to have sales contests where first prize was lunch with him. I used to ask him, what's second prize? Two lunches with
right.
you? And I didn't want to work for this guy. George from IBM, that's his real name. I didn't
so
want to work.
Find him on
I didn't
want
to
networks.
Work for him anymore. I want to be responsible for my own successes and my own failures, just like you were saying.
Mm-hmm. So now, what inspired you to kind of step away from all of this, all this business, and start writing books on failure? What was it about failure that drew you?
Well, first of all, I had to step away because I had no choice. My wife, after we sold the last business, July of 1999, during the internet bubble, so I was very lucky. My wife said, okay, that's it. For the next 10 years, you are not allowed to start another business or have any employees for 10 years, for the next decade. By the way, that was up this past July 9th.
Ooh, nice. So what are you planning? So,
I'll tell you later. So that was 10 years. She said, that's it. I'm done. You dragged me through enough mud. So, Cassie, I really had no choice because my spouse said, that's it. So I wanted to write about my experiences because if you remember, those of you who went through the internet bubble, starting your own business during 1999, 2000 was a get-rich-quick scheme, right? Mm-hmm. You wrote a business plan, you got paid millions of dollars, and you retired.
And it worked really well for
about six or seven people, right? So that's the way it was supposed to go. I wanted to write a book about what it was really like, all the good and bad stuff. That's why I called You Have to Be a Little Crazy, The Truth About Starting Your Own Business. So that's really what led me to that, and then people started me to talk about it. The reason I wanted to write a book on failure is because, as we talked from the outset, I don't like magazine covers like the one for Wired, where it says, you know, let's talk about failures. Here's all the things we can learn from failure. I think we have to understand, as I said from the outset, if we could just learn whatever we can, but mostly if we just let go of failure, we'd be far ahead of everybody else. So I wanted to get that message out there. And that the key to being a successful entrepreneur is really this idea of resiliency, that you develop true business confidence by being able to bounce, celebrate your successes, mourn your failures, but then get ready for your next success.
Mm-hmm. That goes on with a lot of the investors at FailCon told me, where they would actually much prefer to invest in a company or to invest in a founder that had a company that had failed.
Right.
Rather than a company that had one success and they were huge. So like the Mark Zuckerberg versus Mark Pincus argument of, do you invest in the founder of Facebook or the founder of a failed social network who then had a later success?
Right. Well, this is a really good point because as an angel investor, I would never invest in someone that's never failed before because I don't want them fail for the first time in my nickel.
Right.
Because I want to know, how do they come back? Mm-hmm. Because guess what? Even when you have a success, there will be times where you'll have to come back. And how do you deal with it? And how do you handle it? Do you have the resiliency to keep going, to move on, to, as you say, pivot, to change? Success in business has a lot to do with changing directions and morphing what you're doing. There are very, very few businesses, as we said before, Cassie, that start over here and end up over here.
Mm-hmm. So personally, how can I prepare myself for that pivot at an early stage, just knowing that, but you said 60% of companies, 70% of companies are going to have to go through it. Are there a few little points I can kind of put down in my life to say, okay, I need to have that ready and that ready and that ready? Or any alerts, red flags I should look out for?
I think you have to keep listening to what the customers are telling you. What are the customers buying? In my third business, which I eventually sold, it was a mail order catalog that sold scientific and technical software. You have to understand this was the early 90s, and if I wanted to buy a piece of statistics software, if I wanted to buy a mathematics software, I couldn't go on Google. There was no place to go. We create a mail order catalog for as a place to go. Part of our business model was not advertising in that magazine. One time, one of our vendors called us up and said, hey, we really like to be listed in your magazine, but would you mind if we place an ad? And we're like, sure. And I will tell you that 50% of the revenue from the company a few years later was advertising revenue. And we never even thought about that. You have to keep listening to what your customers are saying, what they're willing to buy. Now, you have to balance that with, as you were saying before, sometimes customers know what they want, so they'll take you in all sorts of different directions. I think you got to be nimble. You got to be willing to evolve and shift. There's very few businesses that stay the same over a period of time. I mean, look at the movie rental business. Blockbuster, I think, is doing better, but they're still dealing with how Netflix changed the movie renting business. But they have to move and they have to change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been tough for them.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your wife does not want you starting another business.
Right.
I immediately see my parents talk to me about kind of the high-risk behavior I am exerting. And my high-risk behavior was not drinking or drugs. It was starting my own company.
Right.
How do you incorporate your family and their needs and their desires for you into that? Or is it just marrying the right person?
It's funny because in one of my books, I talk about, you know, what is the role of the spouse?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very, very difficult. I mean, when you have your own business, really what it's like driving this tiny little car. You're on this winding mountain road. You know, you're going round and round and round. You keep banging into the guardrails. You're trying not to go off the side of the cliff, right? And guess what? Your spouse in the backseat of that car turned around and blindfolded. It is very, very difficult to be the spouse of an entrepreneur. And at the same time, you really do need their support. So you have to take them through the ups and the downs. I think you have to be, I wouldn't say necessarily open and honest with your spouse, because quite honestly, I didn't tell my wife, Sarah, everything, because for the reason, I didn't want to relive everything every single day,
sure,
all the good and
sure.
bad things that happen. But you have to take them on this ride. Well, I think the one of the most important things you can have to be successful entrepreneur, you have to have some type of support system, whether that be your family, your spouse, whether it be your friends, whether it be your mentors, because you're going to hit those bumps in the road. In 1995, I woke up and I had blurry vision, and I was diagnosed with diabetes, and it was a very, very bad time for me. And I had to stop running my business for 6 months, but I realized with the help of my family, my friends, my business partner, and to be honest with you, some really great pharmaceutical drugs, was I able to bounce back and run those businesses again. So if you have that net, if you have that catcher, mm-hmm. you really have a lot more confidence in the world.
So going on the business partner aspect, I know I had a business partner in my venture, and we actually would talk very frequently about the traits I had, the traits he had, how we balanced each other. What would you suggest, first of all, having a partner? I've heard mixed results of, do you start your business? Do you look for a partner? Do you go for it? Do you not? And if you're looking for a partner, what should you be watching for to try to, okay, not avoid the failures, since you
sure.
say don't worry about avoiding them, but get through them and bounce back from them?
I think having a partner will either be given to you or it won't. The situation either necessitates a partner or it doesn't. If you can have a business and own it by yourself, I believe that you should. It's a lot simpler. It really is. However, if you need money, that's going to require a business partner. If you're going to need a skill, that's going to require a business partner. The most important thing to remember is a business partner is another marriage, except this time without the sex.
Right.
It's all about communication.
And a much longer contract.
Right, much longer contract. It's all about communication. If you can communicate in your business partner, with your business partner, that will be the key really to everything. And the most important thing when you get started is to have some kind of a written agreement that says what happens if you want to sell your part of the business, if you die, if you get disabled, you get divorced, what happens if your partner wakes up one day and they're ugly, what do you really do? If you have that agreement up front, things will go a lot smoother. I do a lot of mediation between business partners who don't get along. And you think that spouses can fight when they get a divorce? Business partners can really fight because they have the support of their spouses. In the end, only the lawyers win. But if you have good communication and good agreement, it can really go a long way.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to be going to questions in about 3 minutes. So start thinking about them in your head. I know there's a mic somewhere. There it is. You guys can start lining up there. That'd be great because I want to know your questions since mine are just on my own business. You have an interesting story with some of your first partners. And did you learn anything from that experience? You could certainly tell the story. Any red flags that don't work with people like this, or that?
Well, the story that Cassie's referring to is I found my second partner in the classified section of the Chicago Tribune newspaper.
A do not do on that list.
Right, a do not do on that list, right? You might find a car or a house or a boat in the Chicago Tribune, but not your business partner. And eventually, they kicked me out of the business.
What did that ad say? How did you put an ad out for a business partner?
They were looking for money to help fund their business, which was going, and I happened to have money to fund their business to get going. I was looking to start my own business, and it was in a technology area. It was in voice-activated computing, you know, like Dragon software where you talk to computers. This was back in the early 90s, and we're still not there yet.
Oh, no.
Anyway, long story short, they eventually kicked me out of business after a year. And the thing that I learned from that, which I actually did learn something from this, is it's not what you're doing in your business. It's who you're doing it with. People is the most important thing in business. In my third business, I said I was doing scientific and technical software. I thought it was really boring. But the market was very interesting, and the guy I was doing with was really a great and interesting guy. Find the people that you want to go work with and go work with them,
okay, so
regardless what it is.
How important is the money, that one of you have money, or should one of you just be able to get money? How big
it all depends on your business, right? If you're a service-oriented business, it usually doesn't take a lot of money to start a service-oriented business. If you're going to manufacturing or machinery, you got to create a product, someone's needed money somewhere along the line. It all depends on how soon you can get to getting a customer to pay for your product and actually receive the money.
Mm-hmm. So great. I think, are we good, Caroline? And we're going to open up some questions, the floor for questions. None of you jumped in line. I think someone should jump in line now. There's a nice little mic right there. Oh, look at that. Go. That's wonderful. Thank you for
now. The first person to ask a question gets a... Oh, we don't have to offer that because we already have a question.
Done. Don't say anything more.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
In your experience, earlier you guys spoke a lot about the negative consequences with failure. In your experience, have you seen any negative consequences associated with people holding on to success too long?
Oh, sure. I mean, you look at a lot of people out there that have only had one success, and they keep playing it over and over and over and over again. And I think it actually hurts them in the long run because they can't get past that one success that they had a long, long time ago. I think you should celebrate it, hold it in your back pocket for when things really get down, but try to move on to successive successes. So many times we see actors and actresses, right? They only can play one role, and they just keep recreating that role over and over again. But I think there's a different question of that, if I could add to that.
Please.
I think many of us don't stop to celebrate success enough, believe it or not. I think it's important.
Thanks.
Hi. I'm a language tutor of English, French, German, and Spanish, and I used to get plenty of students mostly with college flyers, but for, I don't know, 10 years or even a little more, it's very hard to get students. Plus, with the economy, private tutoring is not a total necessity. I still want to do it, but I'm... do you have any ideas about how I can maybe get students?
Sure. The question I'd ask you is, who is your real customer? Is it the student or is it the parent?
I taught adults as well as some students.
So
sometimes children.
I don't know if we want to take up the time here with this, but I actually have a client who's in the tutoring business, and her business is doing very well because here's the time where people are investing a lot of money in their kids. Mm. So we can talk afterwards, and we can talk about how do you actually target the parent, not the student, because I think the parents are the ones that have the money.
Mm-hmm. Does one need a website, which I don't have? I don't know if that would be a lot more successful.
The key is, how do you find the people that need it, mm-hmm. where they congregate, mm-hmm. and how do you get referrals?
Because I have gone to some private schools, and that wasn't too successful either.
Well, let's talk offline about it, because I think it's a longer answer, but thank you.
Having identified businesses that would be potential customers, I'm curious about breaking the ice with people in that business and kind of how do I get my foot in the door to a potential customer?
So more specifically, how do you get someone interested in doing what you're doing?
Interested in, willing to talk to me is basically the idea.
Well, mostly you need to probably get a referral, right? Or you need to meet them somewhere along the line. So a referral is very powerful because remember, in business, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Okay.
So you need to have someone bridge that gap. So say, all right, you know, Cassie, I want you to meet this person. And most people will do that. And if you can find out what their pain is, what mm-hmm. they really need to buy, what they need to solve, and do they have any money, that will really go a long way. But you have to see if they're interested first. See, I don't believe that we actually can sell anything to anybody. We just need to be there when people are ready to buy. And that's a little bit different. That's where marketing comes into effect, right? I'm here. I'm here. Tell people you're here. And eventually, when they have the pain and the money to solve the pain, they'll come to you. But you got to get referrals. That's the most important thing. Cold calling, I don't believe in.
So how would you meet those people that are going to give me a referral?
I would try to find out the people I want to meet. And guess what? You can figure, anybody in this world, you can figure out how to get to them, given enough time.
LinkedIn. connecting me at home.
Just keep asking. Listen, I want to meet an executive from Zappos. Does anybody know an executive from Zappos? Guess what? You'll eventually get to meet Tony Hsieh. Guaranteed.
I'm going to hold you to that one.
All right.
I had a different question, but since you mentioned cold calling, you don't believe in cold call. Why is that? And if that was really the traditional way that people are developing business, what is alternative way of developing other than referrals? That's referrals, I believe you already have established group of network.
Right.
But when you're starting from fresh, what do you do if you don't believe in
aside from cold call?
Well, I think you have to do marketing, right? And marketing takes many different forms. Marketing could be attending networking events because you're marketing yourself, right? It could be attending conferences. It could be going into various chat rooms that have to do with your area. It could be forming various, joining various Facebook groups and joining those kind of conversations. You have to let people know that you exist and how you can really help them. And that's all part of marketing. And then you get referrals.
I'm going to jump in for a moment too, just because I do networking events. And I think a big thing is, one, don't be afraid. Like, on the one hand, I agree that you shouldn't cold call. Don't cold call with your business. But don't be afraid of just sending an email that's just asking them some questions, getting some information. I've gotten some top speakers just by emailing them once and saying, I just would love kind of your opinions on this. So there is a lot of just really put yourself out there, walk into an event, have questions ready to ask the people at the event. And you'll be surprised who you meet.
But you're information gathering. You're not selling them something.
Right.
And that's the
difference,
first step. Right? You need to information gather. People don't want to be sold stuff. People want to buy. Remember that.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Erin, and I'm a financial advisor, and life is good. I'm working hard, focused on my business. And then let's say I have these great business ideas on the side, but I don't want to take away from my growing business now to pursue something else. And I don't want someone else to take the idea or, you know, to do it. And I think it's something that's going to solve the pain or, you know, kill the pain for a lot of people. So what would you do or what do you recommend would be the best way to approach this if I don't have a lot of time to pursue something else, but it's a great idea that I believe will be a great business idea?
Are you in your own business now?
I am.
Okay, so this is a business that has nothing to do with your business.
Right, it's just great idea that I thought of that I know will solve the pain and people will pay for it, but I don't want to take away from my current business to do that. Or I don't want to take away, I don't want to be too spread too thin.
Is the idea time sensitive?
Well, if someone else heard it, I think that they would do it, or it would blow up pretty fast.
But remember, I think business ideas are meaningless, right? I think it's all about execution, right?
Right.
So you could probably tell us the idea right now, and someone else here would probably execute it, but they may not be as successful as you executing it. I think you have to be very, very careful, because I think the nature of entrepreneurs is we're really good starters, right? We're not really good finishers. We constantly want to start something new. I'm a great starter.
Yeah.
And I think you got to be careful that you don't start something else that takes away currently what you're doing. Now, if you could find a trusted partner that perhaps you could advise and they could take the information or the idea, that might work. But they may not do it the same way you want to be done. So unless it's time sensitive, I'd probably wait or try to find a way to integrate it into my current business. It's a tough one. It's tempting, isn't it?
So let's say you have like an invention idea that's very simple but will solve the pain, but you don't want someone to take it, so you want to just execute.
Well, for an invention idea, if you think it's really an invention, you can go out and you can patent it. But at the same time, patents are only worth the amount of money you have to defend those patents, right? Because, again, you can create a product, but if you can't get it to market, then what's the difference?
Right.
So I think it's a tough one.
Thank you.
As in most things, there isn't any set answer to that. But I would err on the side of just focusing on your current business.
Thanks.
Hi, it's... It sounds like you went through a really kind of a difficult initial partnership in your initial business. And
it was the second one. The first one actually was a friend of mine. We ran a business, but we stayed friends and actually married my business partner.
Well, that's very successful then. So I have a question for you. So right now I have a business. We're having some moderate success right now, and there's three principals. And one guy really just isn't, he's a nice guy, smart guy, but isn't doing nearly as much work as the other two. So just wondering, in terms of kind of restructuring a partnership and kind of the importance of addressing that early on and so forth, I mean, how important do you think it is to kind of restructure something if you're finding these inequities, or should you just kind of wait it out and try to avoid the pain for a while, hoping that the other person's going to hold up their weight down the road?
Well, that person's not going to change, so you really should do it now. Because as the company grows and it becomes more valuable, it's going to be more difficult to change. Do you have a partnership agreement or a shareholder agreement?
Yeah.
What does it say about how does it address that at all?
Yeah. The guy who's not holding his weight is actually an attorney. So
so it's a little bit tougher. I would address those things now, because remember, what you can do if you're at an earlier stage is you can probably take your ball and go home, and the two guys that are really pulling the weight, you can just close it down and start another business. And that would be the leverage that you have over this person, perhaps to change the percentage, perhaps get them to do more work, something like that. But if you're going and you're already $1 million or $10 million company, it gets to be more difficult. Yeah. So I'd do it now.
Any tips on how to address that? I know I get that question a lot of how do you go up to a partner and essentially say you're not doing enough work without, ruining the relationship entirely?
I would open up the discussion and saying, is this meeting your goals? Is it working out well for you? What are you doing? What we're doing? But eventually you have to tell him, guess what? If your other partner feels the same way?
Well, we can talk about it offline. Okay. There's a very deep relationship between those two. So
it's very complicated. Yeah. Let's talk about it. I think you'd have to have an honest conversation. But remember, your fallback always has to be, well, guess what? If this doesn't work it out, I'm going to go do something else.
Great, thanks.
You're welcome.
Cool. Hey, thank you for being here. One of the things that really spoke to me was just when he said, failure gives you choices. Yeah. And I was going through kind of how the couple steps that you said, how to deal with failure. And each one of those was a choice. So a choice to face the fear or give up the shame or, to make the choice, failure giving you that opportunity. What kind of value or what is the power of choice? And I'd just like to hear you kind of elaborate a little bit more on that.
Well, I think I think most of us get down because we feel like we don't have a choice, right? If we feel like there is no choice but to go do that, but if we feel that there is another avenue and there is a way out, it gives us hope. And it gives us, if we feel like we have another chance. So I think choice is very powerful. Don't you?
Yeah.
You and I talked a little bit about always having another possibility lined up, and that's the best way to bounce. That it's very hard to get out of your slump when there isn't anything to climb towards. That there's just, I finished that project, I have nothing new lined up, or that project didn't go well. Just addressing that as well, the idea of choice, that I had choices, I made one, is it possible to keep the other one as an option for when I need to bounce back?
But I think the most important thing is to realize in life, there's always choices. I mean, there's very, very few times where there isn't. Try to think of a time where there isn't a choice. It may not be a very good choice, but there is a choice. And I think that gives us hope, and that gives us an avenue to keep proceeding. I wouldn't necessarily forward, because I don't think life is linear, but to go to another step, to leave the place where you're at. And sometimes the choice is just not to be sitting here, to be sitting over there. All right?
Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions that you guys are burning to ask right now? We still do have an open mic. Good. I'm going to go off on one of the questions that one of you asked. So you do talk about that sometimes failure is not, you just can't learn from it. Someone asked about success as well. Are there successes you can't learn from? And how do you figure out the things that there just really isn't a lesson to learn from? Because I know I tend to overthink everything my business does.
Right. It's a really good question. Are there successes you can't learn from? Of course. Sometimes you just get darn lucky, right?
You win the lottery.
I mean, I always ask people, would you rather be lucky or would you rather be good? I'd rather be lucky, because lucky makes it seem like I'm good, right? Yes. So success is sometimes you just get lucky and you can't learn something from it. A lot of times we make it up that, oh, this is how we got the success, things like that. And it was just luck in the long run. The way that you learn something, I think that you should ponder it for a day or a week. What can I learn from it? And then you should move on.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't keep going and saying, what can I learn from, what can I learn from, what can I learn from it? As I said, I think that if we keep thinking what we can learn from failures, it keeps us stuck. It doesn't help us to move forward and to give ourselves another choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem most people have with failure. They just keep staying in this failure mode. The biggest example is constantly in sports. You see someone that does really poorly on a pro sports team, and guess what? He moves to another team, and how does he do? Sometimes he does really great. Why didn't Cedric Benson do really well on the Chicago Bears? Why didn't Thomas Jones do real well on the Chicago Bears? What's happening with Jay Cutler now in the Chicago Bears? It's amazing how sometimes when you get a change of scenery, if you're just in a different place, you can have success.
Sure. Now, is there any way to kind of draw luck towards me? I mean, luck is, you and I have both acknowledged that luck is an important part of success. Any way, I mean, my answer might be no, but...
Some people say the harder you work, the luckier you get. I don't believe that. I think that you have to really keep a lot of balls up in the air.
I did notice a couple of the heads nodding.
Yeah,
I
know. Well, again, those are stories I believe we tell ourselves. If I work really hard, I'm going to get really lucky. I think if we keep a lot of balls up in the air, you have more chances to succeed. I think if you build a strong, vibrant network and you keep trying to help other people and they help you and you refer other people, they're referred to you, things will come along that will really help you. I was just waiting here. Someone I met about 2-3 months ago, she just invited me to speak at a conference in London. You know, was that lucky or good? I don't know, but it was a result of networking, because you just keep keeping things out there in the community.
Sure, sure. So one of the questions, our key questions for these in the know panels is, you have 60 seconds to tell me, how are you going to change the world?
I have a little bit different view of that, Cassie, because I believe the way that we need to change the world is actually to strive for minimal achievement. Now, I know some of you have been sitting out there thinking, I've been waiting my whole life for a guy to say this. I actually can do this one. What I mean by striving for minimal achievement is actually to, as I say, downsize your dreams, to actually focus on one thing at a time. We've gotten too much involved in this world in multitasking. Multitasking really hurts. We are creating a generation of attention deficit disorder individuals. There's a lot of power out there in your lives, your business, by focusing on one thing at a time, as I said, by striving for minimal achievement.
That's a pretty good one. I'll have to live for that one. So I didn't read this before the Q&A. I had all my note cards mixed up. But as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, and tonight we're hosting Failing Up in Business. I'm Sandra Phillips. I'm the producer and creator of FailCon and the moderator for this evening. And I'm in discussion here with entrepreneur extraordinaire and author of the book Bounce, Failure, Resiliency, and Confidence to Achieve Your Next Great Success, Barry Moltz. Now we're wrapping up the evening because I put that one in the wrong place. So let's give a big hand for you, Barry Moltz. Thank you for meeting with us today.
Thanks for having me, Cassie.
I also forgot to do the gavel. I've thrown all of you off really badly, and I'm
sorry. Does
that
mean we need to start over again?
We do. We should do the whole thing again. No. So now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.